Good to see you. If you're new here, my name is Joel. I'm one of the leaders here in the church. We have teaching from the Bible each week, and we've been going through a story in the New Testament where Jesus gathers his closest followers, the 12 apostles, 12 disciples, and he talks to them about a big shift in terms of his plan and his purposes. He starts to talk to them, in fact, about the church. And so the subject of our session today is that very theme, the church. I also want to talk again about money, because at the start of the year, it's important especially to touch on those things so that we know where we're going, we can achieve all we want to achieve. And money is only one part of being a disciple. It's a really important part, but it's one part. God has been kind to us as a church. You need to understand, this stuff in this book has inspired us to make big decisions, to take big risks, to go on big adventures. We used to meet just in this building only, 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And now we meet in four different locations across the city. We've grown. We've reached hundreds of new people in the last few years. We've started churches in three major cities. Two church plants in Berlin, one in Amsterdam, one we're just starting in Ottawa. This is, it's such an adventure. We're on such a steep learning curve. We are having a blast. You need to know that. It's such a joy to be part of a church that's moving, that's going forward. It is a privilege. It's such an excitement to be part of it. And listen, my longing, and I'm sure yours if you're part of this as well, is we get to do more, not less. We feel like we've hardly started. God spoke to me 10 years ago about moving to this city. And ever since then, I've known he's called me. He has called me. Even on my weekdays, I do know this. And because I know he's called me, I want to press in with everything. I want to achieve as much as possible. Financially, there's a big thing that we have to do. We need to prepare ourselves for this. Let me just land this practically. I've done this before. Let me do it again, just for the sake of those who may have not heard this. When we talk about giving, we talk quite airy-fairy about, you know, just need more money. Could we just have a bit more money? Please, please, please give more money. Sometimes we need to be a bit more specific. Say if just once a month, so we just thought, I could give a five or more a month. A five or more. Now you might think, how can these things be? You know, that sounds impossible. It's not that hard. For example, you know, I guess most of us in the room probably go to a coffee place now and then, maybe once a week. Get a latte and a muffin, say, for example. I'm sure most of us do that now and then, maybe once or twice a week. Say if you did that one less time a month. Just say. I know that's scary for us. I know we're sweating now. I just said that. But just imagine, hypothetically, okay, don't wet yourself. Just once a month, all right? We just do this. Now, if you did this, that's by the end of the year, 60 quid. Now, imagine 30 people doing that. 1,800 quid. It's pretty good. That's just 30 people. Imagine if 400 people did it. 24 grand. 24 grand, that's sort of like a starting salary for someone who's a trainee pastor, starting a church maybe, starting a site, starting a service. Wow. It's just a few people. What about if 1,200? Now, it's roughly 1,200 adults come to us on a good Sunday in Church of Christ the King at the moment, across all the locations. 72 grand. Well, that's a big deal. That's like a venue. Plus, no, that's more than a venue. That's like a year's venue plus someone's salary, plus travel expenses, maybe accommodation. Seriously, that would be like a church plant. Why? Because the people in church just say, oh, I'll just hold back on the lattes this month. Why am I saying this? Because I'm anti-Starbucks? No. All right, that's not my point. My point is, I want you to think in very practical terms. We wave around these forms quite often, these standing order forms. And we do it because we want you to help you. Not everyone wants to give by a bank transfer on the internet, or, you know, most givers in the church do that, which is why, by the way, people will take the bucket and pass it on. It's not just because they're tight. They might be, but it's just as likely it's because they're saying, well, I already give by standing order. There's a lot of that that goes on. And again, that's brilliant. Good for you. I understand that. But this is so helpful to do. It helps you to set budgets. It also helps the church to have a bit of a plan in terms of bookkeeping for the year. Imagine if every site of this church managed to put together about 15 to 30 more standing orders just this year. If there were 15 people in this room who said, yeah, I'll do that, maybe you're one of them, just 15, we actually would be, that would change everything in terms of how much we could achieve, we could push forward. Now, if you're new here and you're thinking, I knew it was that kind of church, trust me, we're just glad you came. We're not after your money. I'm talking to the people who are part of this church. Hear me? You got that? I'm talking to people who know this is their church and they're already involved. And if you're excited about what I'm saying, I'm talking to you. If you're not excited, I'm not talking to you, okay? Don't worry about it. I'm not asking you for your money at all. I'm talking to those who know this is right, but they just need to get into the habit. Do you understand? Okay, so Matthew chapter 16 and verses 13 to 20. I'll read to you, then we'll get into it. It says this. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. So when I talk to people about Jesus in one-to-one conversations, whether it's friends or people that I've just met who aren't necessarily Christians, I've got used to using the line, don't look at the church, just look at Jesus. Just ignore the church for a moment. Just get your eyes on Jesus. That's the most important thing. Let's just ignore the church. The reason I have to say that is because often people's objections to Christianity are to do with the record that the church has, whether it's towards them personally, like bad experiences that they may have had with church or churches or individual Christians, or the history of the church, the bad things that the church seems to be associated with. And whatever we think of the church, whatever we think of Christianity, or to use the phrase that everyone in 21st century Brighton likes to use, organized religion, you know, organized, whatever organized religion is, we tend to dismiss those things, but we like Jesus. We're up for Jesus. We don't mind Jesus. We're interested in Jesus. We respect him. We might even kind of like him. But the church, man, the church is such a beast, such a monster, such a kind of horrible burden for Jesus to carry around with him. And I've got used to that way of kind of dealing with this. But I think there's more that could be said to help us with this whole disparity between Jesus and the church. Let me just pick out three or four things as an intro to this message first to help us to sort of tidy up this relationship. The first of them is just the issue, you could call it the issue of branding. The issue of scale when it comes to branding, especially. Now, since I'm preaching this in Brighton and Brighton and Hove and Shoreham, and since 50% of the population of this area works in, you know, marketing or branding, or at least has their own company or is, you know, is self-employed, or, you know, most of you are graphic designers, I'm sure. Basically, everybody's very conscious, I think, of the whole issue of how you protect a brand, how you keep it pure. I mean, Brighton is definitely the mecca for the startup, for the small company, for the self-employed. We're definitely into things remaining authentic, organic, real. We're not into big. We're not into scale. We're not into the man. No one wants to sell out to the man. It's when Coldplay got big that they got bad. It's when Starbucks got big that they sold out. We don't want anything big, and we're not interested in scale. We want to make sure things are kept and manageable, and the brand is kind of, we can control it more when it's small. It's a little easier to do that. And when things get big, when they get huge, when they get global and corporate, that's when we're a little suspicious. And has anything ever got corporate more than Christianity? Christianity is like, it's so big and it's sold out to the man. You know, Christianity is Tesco. It's just, it's a beast. And so obviously it means that people kind of get in on it who aren't necessarily of it. That might be a helpful way to explain it. You know, you can get in on a big global franchise just by wearing the right uniform and, you know, folding the bag over and saying have a nice day when you give them the milkshake. It's like, you know, I'm in on the franchise. Even if I'm not really at the heart of it, I'm in because I've said the right things. And that could help. I mean, Jesus did talk about people who would claim to be his who are not. He did talk about it. He told one or two stories to help us to expect a day of reckoning when he will filter it out. It's a significant part of what he taught. He said there's going to come a day when the wheat and the tares, the sheep and the goats, you know, the grain and the chaff will be separated. And the things that are genuine will be seen for it, and the things that are false will be seen for it. And that's a warning to anybody. When I was at school, my headmaster used to say, don't you go home doing, you know, unspeakable things on the bus. Whatever you do, don't beat up old women or set fire to the bus driver or whatever. Don't do that unless you take off that uniform. If you're wearing that uniform, don't do anything. If you take it off, do whatever you like, because when you're wearing it, you represent this school. You carry our identity with you. And it's like that with the church. We carry his identity, whether we kind of should be wearing the uniform or not. And you could say that church history is a story of a lot of people putting the uniform on who aren't from the school. A lot of people saying, well, yeah, I represent Jesus. And some horrendous things have happened. The church has been responsible for dire things, you name it, from the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, Songs of Praise, the whole load of stuff that has buried the church with the whole, you know, negative reputation. And obviously, that could be explained, at least could be explained partly by us saying, well, not everything that claims to be Christian is Christian. That's kind of helpful, isn't it? Now, bear in mind, you know, that shouldn't be the go-to excuse. Because if we're not careful, we're opting for a pretty purist version of the Christian message. The fact of the matter is that Jesus definitely chooses some ropey people. So it's no good Christians saying, well, I know they did a bad thing, but they're not really a Christian. She did a bad thing, she's not really a Christian. We Christians would never do that. If I read this book right, I've noticed that some of God's people do some horrendous things. In fact, the people he's speaking to in this very part of the Bible are very flawed, very weak. People like Peter himself, who he's going to say, Peter, on this rock I'll build my church. Peter, you're one of the key men. You're one of the foundations of this enterprise. This whole project is going to be built around you and guys like you. Man, that is a significant risk, you could say, because the church is made up of flawed people. We can't hide that. And we can be encouraged, in fact, by that. Hopefully I'll make more of a point of that before I finish. But let me say one other thing, and that is that however well we do in terms of showing off the goodness of Jesus to our culture and our society, however well we represent him, we can't avoid ultimately the conflict, the reaction, even the kind of the bad taste in the mouth that we can leave. And that isn't necessarily down to how well we're doing. It could even be that we're being very faithful to Jesus. But people will still have a negative conception of the church simply because we represent someone who causes a reaction in the human heart. Jesus himself said this to the disciples. He says later on, he says, do not be deceived. No man is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If Jesus, the perfect Jesus, could get so badly treated and so reacted against, then friends, we're not going to avoid the same response. There's a place in the New Testament where the Apostle Paul kind of makes this point in quite a graphic way. He says in 2 Corinthians and chapter 2, he says, for we are the aroma of Christ to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. To one, a fragrance from death to death. To the other, a fragrance from life to life. Who is sufficient for these things? You get his point. He's saying, you're always, if you belong to Jesus Christ, without meaning to, you're giving off this fragrance, this spiritual fragrance. And for some people, it's attractive. For others, it's appalling. It's like, ugh, where is that coming from? And we can't really, we can't change the way people will respond to us. The one thing it means we shouldn't do is make an idol out of popularity, because we're never going to get that. Well, Jesus is not promising that if the church would just get its act together and just do a better job at really being good and really loving people and really caring about people and really serving the poor and serving society and seeking out justice and having amazing meetings with incredible musicians and amazing lights and everything was just perfect, then at last we would look pretty good. Jesus never promises that. Jesus said, no, if they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. It's not going to go. In fact, you know, just 20 years ago, Christopher Hitchens, a great journalist, he wrote a massive, hard-hitting expose against Mother Teresa. And, you know, it became like a Channel 4 documentary. There was a major push. Some people who just decided to come out publicly criticizing one of the most kind, noblest, kindest, gentlest, generous people that's ever lived. Who loves Jesus, loved people, just gave herself for the poor, completely. And what happens? Well, the world turned on her and attacked her. Which tells me, you know, if they're coming after Mother Teresa, they're definitely coming after me. I'm not going to avoid the world's hostility. I'm never going to be able to make myself so squeaky clean that the church is just perfectly popular in Brighton and Hove. Never going to happen. Let's quit on that goal. Having said all of that, and this, I'm still in my intro, this is really important. Having said all of that, there's something massive for us to see here. And this is really the main point I want to make today. We don't have to settle, in spite of everything I've said so far, for mediocrity. The people of God, the church of Jesus Christ, needn't be content with a negative image of itself, with a kind of dull, dreary, mediocre, disappointing reputation. That's not what we need to accept, because what we see in this passage, and in fact throughout the Bible, is clearly God's intention from the beginning all the way through the Bible that the church in fact should and will be glorious. God's plan from the beginning. We don't have to yield on that. We can say in our hearts, the story is not over. God's plan has always been for a glorious people, and glorious in the richest sense of that word. Knowing, experiencing, hosting his glory. Being the expression of his glory to a watching world, to a dark and needy world. Jesus himself talked this kind of way earlier on in Matthew's gospel. In fact, just a few pages before this, in chapter 5, he makes this famous comment. He says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." That's Jesus raising the bar. That's him saying that's how it can be, and that's what it shall be. That's my intention for my people. They shall be the light of the world. That will be their reputation ultimately. That will be the claim. That will be the statement. People, the nations will look at my people. This city set on a hill can't be hidden, not distorted, not pushed down, not drowned out by the noise and the sound and the vision of a passing culture, but set apart, gloriously standing out before a watching world, a city on a hill, and that people will see the church and see its love, see its fellowship, see its mutual care and kindness, see the way they love each other, see the devotion, the purity, see the dignity, see the justice, see the passion, see the compassion. They'll see God's glory and they will glorify the Father. They'll see the church and they'll honor God as a result. That's what Jesus is looking for. That's his plan for the church. And friends, trust me, this is not marginal to the Bible. This isn't like on the edge. This isn't like, you know, in the maps at the back. This is central. This is a major theme from beginning to end, right at the heart of God's story through history and eternity is his burning passion to have a glorious global people who represent him. The church is and always has been at the center of his zealous passion. It's who he is. It's what he longs for. The church. He's not thinking, well, I've sent my son Jesus, we got preaching and they started this thing, you know, of telling people about Jesus, and you get left over these kind of Christians. Ugh. You get this church thing left over. Listen, when you read this, where Jesus is gathering the 12, you need to understand this is a dramatic moment. He's saying to them, who do you think I am? And they say, you're the Christ. This is a breakthrough moment in world affairs, Matthew chapter 16. And he's using this as the moment to unveil his plan. He said, now you know who I am, we're ready. You're ready. I'm going to drop one on you here that's going to last all your lives. And it's going to last, it's going to get written down, it's going to last for thousands of years. Are you ready for this? It's called the church. This is the thing. Guys, I've been waiting for months to have a chance to tell you about my dream. Do you get, you know, like a CEO sitting the kind of the board of directors down, or the coach before the 90 minutes is about to start. He's just about to unfold the dream. So here's how it's going to go. Here's how we're going to play. This is the match. This is the game. Here's the huddle. Look, get together. I want to strategize. I want to talk big. I want to talk vision. I want to talk dreams. Let's get the whiteboard out. Let's start brainstorming. Let's see what could come of the dream that's in my heart. I want to share it with you. That's what we've got going on in Matthew 16. So when Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock. That was what Peter's name means. It means rock. That's why he says it. On this rock, on you, Peter, on you and your confession, on who you are, on weak people like you, I will build my church. That's a 5-point sermon right there. All five words could spend 10 minutes on each one. He's saying, this is it, guys. Don't miss it. This is the thing I've dreamed of. This is what I long for. It's what he came for. He's not embarrassed of the church. I might be embarrassed of it sometimes. I'm afraid I have been in my time. Talk embarrassed of it. You know, have you ever had someone in your family or relationship you've been in where you've realized as you're introducing this person, maybe at a party, you've realized I'm talking a bit fast. I'm a bit awkward, a bit embarrassed of this person. Let me tell you, Jesus is not ashamed of his church. His bride, she's called in the Bible. His wife. And he doesn't have any problem introducing her at parties. He has no problem saying, here she is. Let me show you her radiance. Let me show you what I've prepared from eternity. Look, let me show you what I came for, what I died for, how I suffered for her, the way I had to purify her, all the lengths I went through to prepare her as she is before you. We're not talking about a sideshow. If you see the church as a sideshow in your life, catch up with Jesus, please. If you're dating the church, then you should get with it and marry her like Jesus does. You shouldn't flirt with her. You shouldn't see her as on the edge of your life. She's the apple of his eye. She's central. And this is massive for us. It can give us encouragement, such encouragement, to know how special the church is. It can help us to have a certain confidence, a certain pride, if you like. One of our friends, Jay John, he talks about how he answers the question. When people say to him, what do you do? He's a canon in the Church of England. He's a preacher. That's his job. And he's got this brilliant way of answering the question. When he sits down on a bus or on a plane next to someone who's saying, what do you do for a living? Well, you know, a hairdresser or something. And he answers it like this. Let me read it to you. I have to read it because I get the words wrong. He says, I work for a global enterprise with outlets in nearly every country of the world. We've got hospitals and hospices and homeless shelters. We do marriage work. We've got orphanages. We've got feeding programs, educational programs. We do all sorts of justice and reconciliation work. Basically, we look after people from birth to death. and we deal in the area of behavioral alteration. He says, whenever he tells someone that answer, by the end of it, their eyes are like saucers. They're like, wow! What is that organization? It must be amazing. And he says, the church. Oh, yeah. Isn't she incredible? The bride of Christ. Isn't she incredible? The Bible says, kings will rise to your dawn. Nations, far-off islands will see the brightness of God on you. People will travel to see the glorious people of God because of the sight she is. What a sight to behold. We need that perspective. I remember when I was about 16, 17, and I listened to my dad preaching. My dad's, if you don't know, is a preacher as well. And he was talking once about the church, often was, great passion in his preaching. He said, on one occasion, just describing what was happening in a certain situation in South America where Brazilian street children were being dealt with by the police. The police hadn't decided the only way they could deal with some of them was just by shooting on sight, because it was just such a horrendous, they saw them as vermin. It was an awful thing. It was getting headlines in the press. It was just a horrible moment. And he's just preaching, he's telling a story and your heart's broken. He says, the only answer for those children is... And I'm sitting on the edge of my seat thinking, Jesus, you tell him, it's Jesus, it's Jesus, you tell him. And he finishes a sentence, the church. I remember thinking, what? You got the wrong script. No, you got it wrong. No, go back, rewind, you got it wrong. They need Jesus. Well, what do you mean they need the church? And I remember it just looked like my brain just tilted. It was like I just had to align myself, because I realized, and I've realized all the more ever since, the more I've studied this book, the more I've thought about it, the more I've prayed about it, the more I've lived life, I've realized he's right. Of course they need Jesus, but how has Jesus chosen to express himself in the world? How has Jesus identified himself? With which people is Jesus choosing to be identified? The church. The church bears his name. The church carries his presence. The church carries his mandate. It's his people. We have no idea the lengths to which he's willing to go to identify himself with the church. You think about Acts chapter 9, where Saul of Tarsus, that arch persecutor, I mean, he was horrendously violent, wicked, evil man, hated the church, hated Jesus, rounded Christians up, arrested them, wanted them to blaspheme against Jesus, tried to torture them. He did unspeakable things against the church. And then on one occasion, on his road up to Damascus, he's traveling, Jesus appears to him, the risen Jesus Christ from heaven appears to him. He falls off his horse and Jesus speaks to him with the words, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Now that's an interesting expression. Saul says, Lord, who are you? Who are you? I mean, that's what I would say. Who the heck is this? What's going on? Jesus says to him, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. And I can just imagine, I didn't even touch you. I didn't even know you were real. Well, you touched my people, you touched me. In as much as you've done it to the least of my brothers, you've done it to me. You hurt them, you hurt me. It's who I identify. I'm willing to be identified with the despised people of God. Jesus isn't ashamed to call us brothers. Jesus loves his church. A friend of mine planted a church in a huge city in a Muslim-majority country, and a couple came along to the church. The husband became a Christian first, the wife later on. And she at first was pretty dismissive. She was laughing. When she came to the meeting, she thought the Christians were just nutters. She just thought it was poor, silly rubbish. She just went home complaining to her husband about these weird people that he'd made friends with. And maybe that's how you feel. You know, maybe that's how if you come here today with that kind of attitude. Someone's dragged you along and you're like, just weird people. Listen, she goes to bed that night. She has a dream. And in the dream, Jesus appears to her and says to her, why are you mocking my people? She became a Christian shortly after. One of the things that struck her was how willing he is to identify with his people. We need to catch up with him. Do you get my point? I'm trying to make this point because I want you to see it. I want you to see the value, the validity, the wonder of the church, the greatness of the church, the centrality of the church. I want you to be relieved by how special the church is in his sight, the fact that he's willing to do the work. Let me just describe, for example, just in the early pages of the book of Acts, you get to Acts chapter 2, where it describes the church at its kind of early stages. And you get this description of how they were. And just see if you can read this without your appetite being kind of quickened, whetted. It says this: they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers, and awe came upon every soul. And many wonders and signs were being done through the apostles, and all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. What a sensational community. Imagine being part of something like that. Maybe that's what we're building here. Maybe God will help us to do it more and more. Jesus says, I will build my church. He will do it. Let me just finish by talking about three things that means for us. The first thing it means is relief. Jesus said, I will build my church. That means that you and I ultimately don't. We get a part to play. We're like under builders. We get to be on the building site, you know, like my kids trying to help me with something, and I'm like, yeah, thanks for the help. Could have probably got it done faster without you, but thanks for the help. You know, we get a part to play, but he's the master builder. He's doing the work. He will. What a relief to know he's doing it. And the second thing it means is courage. Jesus wants to speak to us as his people from this passage, from this story I read to you, and whisper courage into us. I'm praying that that will happen even right now while I'm speaking, and to those of you watching this on video, that God will speak courage to us. He can do that. He can speak a word and it changes our identity, the trajectory of our lives, our very destiny. His words are that powerful. The Bible says he started the universe by speaking words. There was a day when he spoke to a storm and it was silent. The waves died down, the wind stopped. Jesus has power to speak. When he says to a fisherman of negligible gifting and an unpredictable temperament, who's full of himself and tends to speak before he thinks, Simon, son of Jonah, and he says the words, you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church. It changes a man's destiny. Jesus whispers words of destiny to you, and he says to you, this is who you are. It's dynamic. Something happens. It's authoritative. It's final. It's not the power of positive thinking. It's not encouragement in the kind of vague, fluffy, sentimental sense. It's encouragement. It's strength coming to the heart. It's him saying the truth, feeding us with identity. It's him saying, this is who I see you to be. Friends, if we don't know who he sees us to be, we will be always getting it wrong. We will always be making our own judgment as to our identity. We'll always be trying to suss it out, trying to rationalize. This is what I think I am. This is who I think I'm. Maybe we'll get some help from talking around, and that's wise to humbly listen to other people's critique and help and encouragement and so on. But what we ultimately need, what we desperately need, is for God himself, who spoke creation into life, to speak to us and say, this is who you are. Jesus has a way of doing that. He has a way of saying to us, his people, he says, this is who you are. You're my church. The word that Matthew uses in the Greek, ecclesia, my called out ones, that speaks of authority. It was like a civic council. Every city in the ancient world had an ecclesia. Jesus is saying to his people, you carry authority. You carry dignity. You carry my royal approval. That's who you are. It's not who I feel like I am most of the time. Honestly, it's not. It's not. I don't know about you. I often feel nothing like that. I'm far more conscious, far more subjectively, emotionally aware of failings, flaws, good intentions, but bad results, bad intentions as well, bad motives, mixed motives at best. I'm very aware a lot of the time of just how I fall short again and again. Peter spent years of his life discovering how badly he fell short, how weak he really was, how feeble his efforts were ultimately. Even the best of times, he knew he would blow it again, he'll blow it again and again. This book has so many stories of Peter blowing it. And yet Jesus speaks to him and says, "You are a rock. That's who you are. That's who I see you to be." I wonder today if that's the thing that needs to happen for some of us here listening to this, some of you watching this, to know God's voice whispering to you, "You're mine. You're my people. You're my church. You're my prize, my bride, my representatives, my royal council. You're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation belonging to God. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God." That's the inheritance any child of God can have. Because we're so impressive? Not at all. Because of sheer grace, because of the kindness of a God who declares it over us in spite of who we are. He just says it and it's there. He speaks identity to you. You ever understood that? Don't quarrel with him when he tells you who you are. We do that, don't we? In our flesh, we do that. And we shouldn't. We frankly shouldn't, because when he says about us, "You are mine, you are chosen, you are royal, you are holy," he's speaking about himself. He's saying, "You are part of me. I'm the vine, you're the branches, we are one, you're joined to me. How dare we disagree when he calls us holy?" We've got no right to quarrel with his evaluation. He's authoritative. He's the king. And he says it about his people. "Once we were not a people." It's true. Agreed. "Once we'd not been shown mercy." Agreed. "We're a mess left to ourselves. We're an embarrassment. We're shameful left to ourselves. But in Christ, you are a new creation. You're declared righteous. You're declared whole. You're declared holy." What an identity for us. He's forever doing this. He names people. You've noticed, if you read this book enough, you'll see it as a pattern. He likes doing it. He meets people, he says, "This is your name?" "No, it's not. I'll give you a new one." You notice in the book of Genesis, just for one example amongst, it seems, dozens, where Abram, this sun-worshipping resident of a city called Ur of the Chaldees, just a nobody, comes along. God speaks to him, gives him a new destiny, identity. He changes his name from Abram to Abraham. You need to understand, Abraham's never had any kids. He's 90, his wife's 80, she's barren. No kids. No kids so far, definitely no kids on the horizon. It's done, it's over. That was never an option. It's never going to happen. What does God say to him? "I'll give you a new name." What is the new name? Abraham. What does Abraham mean? "Father of a multitude." What? What are you saying? Imagine Abraham introducing himself at parties. "Hi, what's your name?" "My name's John." "Oh, nice to meet you, John. What's your name?" "Abraham." "Oh, unusual name." "Abraham, what does that mean?" "Father of a multitude." Okay. "So you've got a lot of kids?" "No, none. Not got any kids." "Okay, cool. Okay, I'll just go and talk to someone else over there." It's just weird guy. Weird guy with a weird name that's completely inappropriate. God does this. He gives us names, and it can feel sometimes like it's mocking us. It feels like he's almost trying to get in our heads and upset us. The things God will say to you, you'll think, "How could that possibly be? How could the things that..." You know what it says about the church in this book? The names in the book of Isaiah talks about her as being sought out, chosen, beloved. The mother of many children, the church, the light of the world, the church. What, us? Yeah, us. Feeble us? Yeah, feeble us. We need to catch up with him. When he speaks to you identity, believe him. I could choose so many other stories from Scripture. One story that occurs to me would be just, I guess, a few years ago, I was leading a prayer meeting in this very room, and I was just saying, could you all pray for me? It was just some people there praying for different things. I said, just about to finish, can you just pray for me one more thing? I'm going to be at a meeting. I've been invited to come to a meeting with some senior dignitaries in the city, talking about some issue. I don't really know what to expect. I've been invited. And I did the thing that I do sometimes, the British thing. I said, goodness knows why they invited me. And, you know, gosh, you know, I don't know what I'm going to say. All very kind of Hugh Grant, you know, oh dear, I don't know what I'm going to do when I'm, you know, dear, oh dear, I shouldn't really be going. And I just did the self-deprecating thing, and it's kind of, you know, it's the way we talk if we're Brits and so on. It's anyway, we finished and we prayed, and that was that. And then my dad, who happened to be there, he comes over to me. He says, can I just chat with you? Which normally means something. So, yeah, all right. He said, I don't think that a man who knows he's called to this city would talk like that. Oh, really? I just sort of processing it. He said, either you're called to this city or you're not. Either God has called you or he hasn't. Has God called you? Now, I'd like to say from that point on, I've never struggled in that kind of way, but I'm learning. I'm learning to agree with him, with his calling, learning to line up with what he says. Simon had every reason to say, Peter is not a good name for me, Master. And keys to the king, you shouldn't give me the keys to your shed. I am not ready, that's not me, I cannot do this, this is not me. He had every reason to say, it's not true. He wisely kept his mouth shut for once. Jesus is speaking, I tell you, you are Peter. Do you understand this, friends? I tell you, he says, you are my church. In this city, you are my ecclesia, my royal people. You have my approval. Do you know you have his approval? How do we get his approval? Let me finish with this, because there is a third thing that this gives us. It gives us focus. Focus. We get focus from Jesus. People often say, I've had people say to me over the years, how is your church successful? And they think, I don't think we're that successful at all. I wish we had hundreds of thousands of people, not a few hundred people. But they say, how do you grow? How do you reach people? How do you have people come into your church? That's unusual. And I think they expect me to say, well, because we're quite modern. You know, we've really adapted. I have to say, no, it's because we go back. We're not trying to catch up. We're going back to the old stuff. We're going back to the foundation. We're going back to Jesus. It's because of Jesus. Why does Jesus say, on this rock I'll build my church? Because Peter describes who Jesus really is. Because he gets a moment of revelation. He sees Jesus. The key thing, friends, for you is if you've seen Jesus or not. That's the only thing that really matters. Have you seen Jesus?